All right, we begin tonight where the topic is the Parsha of Pinchas, and the focus is women power. And we have that, we'll get into the episode, specifically the daughter of Tzlafchad. But I want to share first a video. I don't know if you've ever seen this, it's a very interesting video, of Golda Meir, who was the fourth prime minister of Israel and the first prime minister, the first female prime minister, I think, and I think the fourth female prime minister of that time ever in the world. So she was a unique in that. So we're not going to watch the whole clip, but this is early 70s. She's being interviewed by a British journalist and about the Palestinian issue. And what you're going to hear is shocking is fundamentally the issues have not changed in about 50 years. This is very, it's old, but it's contemporary. Here we go.
Has there been a single moment since 1967 when you thought that the Arabs were ready to talk?
Because this is something that must be realized by people in the world, and unless they realize that, there is no understanding of the entire situation. This, their quarrel with the Arabs is not a quarrel for of land. It's not for territory. It's not for anything concrete. They just refuse to believe that we have the right to exist at all. Surely for the people who were here in 48 who have left then, surely for the Jordanians who are now on the other side of the Jordan, surely for them it's land. Don't you understand them? And their desire to come back. They don't like the conquered army. Therefore, we should leave. Oh, that I understand. Yes, then we can have peace in this area. Without Israel in this area, there won't be peace. The Arabs are not so friendly with each other. But that's none of my business. Well, this is a solution. It just happens that there are 14 Arab countries, an immense territory. And we've come back. We've been here before.
2,000 years ago.
And we've come back.
2,000 years ago.
Yes. What did we take away from the Arabs when we came back? We didn't want to live with them in peace. We asked them to leave. We didn't accept the partition of Mr. Churchill in 1922 and the partition of the UN in 1947. We didn't say yes. What difference is there between Arabs who were on this side of the Jordan and the other side of the Jordan, Arabs in the East Bank and the west of the border of the West Bank? When were Palestinians born? What was all this area before the First World War? When Britain got the mandate over Palestine, what was Palestine then? Palestine was then the area between the Mediterranean and the Iraqian border.
You say there's no such thing
as East and West Bank? No. East and West Bank was Palestine. I'm a Palestinian. From 21 until 48, I carried a Palestinian passport. There was no such thing in this area as Jews and Arabs and Palestinians. There were Jews and Arabs. The Arabs are prepared to negotiate with us. Which Arab? Where? When? If you know of an Arab leader, head of state that wants to negotiate with, by all means, tell us. I'm prepared to go to Cairo, I'm prepared to go to Damascus, I'm prepared to go to Amman, I'm prepared to go to Beirut. Anywhere.
You would go to this place?
Yes, possibly. To negotiate peace, of course, we value life, not only our own, just to value life. And this is our strength. Maybe you want to say this is our weakness because Arab leaders are not so sensitive to the very question of life, of having people alive instead of dead. Otherwise, there would be no wars.
Never doubt the correctness of your policy.
No, sir. What do you mean my policy? The policy is to keep our people alive. our independence. How can anybody doubt the right that we have that is similar to the right of 125 peoples in the world?
You were brought up in America. What possible right have you to live in a land that was once Arab and eventually left as a stony desert or not?
To Mojave when there was nothing there. And this land was deserted for centuries. We were driven out of this land. Is this where history begins? Twice we were driven out of this land, occupied by other powers. The Arabs, this is the only people, the Jewish people, whose life, independence, dignity, depends on this piece of soil. The only people in the world, not the Arabs, they have this entire territory, the entire vast area, 14 independent countries.
Isn't time, though, on their side, whatever you do?
Why?
Because they talk of fighting for 100 years, they talk of their population growing. Isn't time on their side?
I don't believe it. You mean you want me to believe that things will never change? That they will go on shooting and killing? You want me to believe that generation after generation of young people in the Arab countries will have no other ideal except to kill Jews? I don't believe it.
You're hopeful.
I'm positive that this will not happen. I don't know how long this war will go on.
Prime Minister, thank you very much.
All right. Okay, so what was your impression of Prime Minister Golda Meir with a rather assertive British journalist? What was your takeaway, anyone?
It was nice to see her speak some truth to the journalist, but a lot of it was lost in the age of the recording, I think. It was difficult to make out some of the things that she was saying.
Okay.
The idea that she had a Palestinian passport until 1948 is really interesting. I didn't know that.
Right.
The idea of a Palestinian, of the modern Palestinian, is a modern creation.
Right.
I think part of the confusion might be, I guess for me maybe, is there the idea of a Palestinian is present in Tanakh. Although exactly how that translates to modern Palestinians, I don't know.
Well, those are the Plishtim. The Romans
translated as Philistine,
right? The Romans gave this area the name, the area of the Judea, and the term Philistine and Palestine is emerging, is a derivative of that, Well, they cobbled together a number of points, but he was classically attacking her at, you came from America and you're showing up here, and what right do you have to displace the Arabs? I mean, it's the same argument that's been stated since the beginning of the state, for the last nearly 70 years. Hey.
Right.
And do you think the war is going to go on forever? And what did you think animated her passion about the situation, Suzanne?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, perfectly.
Okay. I liked how she said, "Show me an Arab leader who is willing to, talk and negotiate. Where is this leader?
Right. And she'll go there. I'll go there. And she says, I'll go right. there happily.
Right.
This is the roughly, I don't know exactly the date. She was the, just a little history. She was the prime minister from 1969 to 1974. Unfortunately, you know, in the 73 war, she was getting conflicting information if they should preemptively operate, what they should do about the massing of the border of the Syrians, etc. They were told emphatically by the United States, if they preemptively attack like they did in 1967, they will not even get one nail from the United States. Not one nail. So she felt prudent not to. And then the core of the
war. That was Jimmy Carter, wasn't it?
No, it was before Jimmy Carter. This was Nixon. Nixon and particularly Henry Kissinger, the Jewish, you know.
Secretary of State for the
United States. Secretary of State, correct. And he's a Jewish guy, and he's telling the Jews are, you know, they're massing up at the Syrian border. And he says, if you preemptively think, we're not going to give you even a nail of support. So she backed off because she's trying to weigh all these issues. In other words, obviously, because you're going to be involved in the war, you need to be resupplied. And the truth was, she played along, and then war broke out, and she mobilized it, and it was a disaster. And if it wasn't for the airlift of arms from America in 1973, which was, you know, until it was turned around, was a horrible circumstance. Thousands of guys died. I think it was 3,000, if I remember correctly, which proportionally for a Jewish nation at that point, maybe 2-3 million is a lot of people. I mean, that means like you're living in a community where everybody, you know, people that have died in the war. It's that level of density of casualties. But then after the war, they had a whole investigation, like what happened. And they found that she made the right decisions with the information that she was given at the time. You know what I'm saying? So, but one thing that she said in the thing, which I thought was very beautiful, was that she said, look, we love life, and maybe that's even a weakness. And we have this optimistic view that the war of the Arabs against the Jews is not going to be eternal. And I don't know how long it's going to last, but she had an optimistic flavor. And you want to, if you want to stop war, that we should leave. So you know, we're not going to commit suicide. And she clearly, you know, articulated her love of the Jewish people, which of course, what would you say makes her a great Jewish leader? I think I've told you part of the answer, but not all of it.
She was able to synthesize strongly Jewish philosophy and empathize with what the Palestinians wanted and needed for themselves, and was trying to find a way to bridge the gap between the two so that we could have what we needed, but not deprive them of what they wanted.
Right. So she's you know, she has a sort of a, on one hand, she has a deep concern for the security and well-being of the Jewish people, and particularly in Israel, A. Well, simultaneously, she doesn't have an interest in hurting the Palestinians or the Arabs. She says, did we ask them to leave in 1948? We did not. They left.
Yeah, well, they were warned by the surrounding countries that they should leave because they were going to destroy the area or everybody in the area.
Right. Well, they also saw when the Israelis were winning, they thought there was going to be a mass revenge, whatever.
Right.
But the point being is that, but did you sense from her on an emotional level, her, as they, she, as, David Green called her the best man in the government. Or, you know, they called her the Iron Lady. Do you see how they came out?
No.
No, they describe it here in Wikipedia. Strong-willed, straight-talking, gray-bunned grandmother of the Jewish people. So this is a person, but what other qualities make her a great Jewish leader? What other qualities?
I mean, the ability to make tough decisions, I guess, in the case of the 73 war.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how difficult a decision that was.
Well, she was also involved in 67 also. She's in the cabinet. She was always a major player.
Well, she was also responsible for, I think it's called Committee X after the 1972 Munich Olympics as well.
That is correct. So, she was outraged by the fact that she was appalled that there was very little world outcry against the fact that the terrorists came in there and killed the 11 Israeli Olympic soldiers, Olympic
athletes,
and therefore that's another quality of Jewish leadership. It should not be that Jewish blood is cheap, insignificant. So she says, and this is a Jewish idea. They have to pay a price. And she organized a group of Mossad guys who are going to take out the people responsible for the entire terrorist plot. And she did. And that's, of course, the movie Munich, artfully produced by Steven Spielberg, shows how in very,
melodramatic fashion.
Melodramatic, graphic Hollywood fashion, how they organized and they got the job done.
Wasn't the 2010 assassination in, Dubai had something to do with that? Or is that...
That was later, and that was viewed as a disaster because they got discovered.
Right.
That was the opposite of success. Yeah, they killed the Palestinian arms dealer, but their identity was revealed. Whatever, that's a separate point. I don't want to get into that. Now, the point of the matter is, I would identify as a Jewish great leader because, A, she is principled, she is determined, she is insistent, consistent, and persistent. She does not care about if it's the right thing, she does the job, and she's like a soldier in that regard. And she has a love and concern for the Jewish people. That's the first principle. And that really is the only principle. And her job is to protect them and nourish them and ensure that they have success. That's her thing. And you don't feel that she's doing it for kavod. If you see her, she looks like a grandmother. She didn't like get into a whole issue of dressing in a certain kind of way. Or, I mean, you know what I'm saying? She wasn't a... Thank you, Viva.
Hi.
Okay. Hi.
Okay. I'm looking for sheet music.
Okay, can you?
I'm sorry. Excuse me. That might be a bigger
question. Okay.
You can continue. I'm not going to judge you. I'll walk
out of there. No, guys. Additional entertainer. Aviva, shut the door in the middle of the street. Sorry about that. A little entertainment.
Bonus Rosenthal's.
That's it.
You can't make it all boring.
Yeah,
she is better than Golda Meir.
Yeah, she's not lacking on the personality department. All right. Anyways, what were we talking about? I have no idea.
So how does Golda Meir parlay into Tzlavchad's daughters?
There you go. Thanks for the transition, Mendel. Let's go to Tzlavchad's daughter. Okay, that takes us to our week's parsha. We have an interesting situation. Set the scene. The scene is that the Jewish people are preparing to they're gathered by the border to go into the land of Israel. They discuss the borders and division of the land of Israel into the various tribes. And then we have the case of the daughters of Slavchan and their issue. So who would like to read?
Again.
All right. Let me just attend. Good.
All right. A petition was presented by the daughters of
Slavchan,
son of Hefer, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, of the family of Joseph's son Manasseh.
Manasseh, I don't know why they don't put that on, they don't make it. All right, Manasseh, okay.
Manasseh.
Right.
Okay. The names of these daughters were Machla, Noah, Hagla, Milcah, and Tirzah.
A lot of these names in Israel are names that people name their daughters.
These days or just back then? Because I hope they sounded a lot nicer back then.
Tirzah, I know Tirzah's. Noah is popular. Milcah, a little bit. I don't know of a Chagla, and I don't know of a Machla. So those two didn't seem to make it, but whatever. Those other ones. So these five women, okay? So they have five daughters of Slavchan, okay? So now we get to go on.
This Noah, is that different than like Noah from like the flood?
No, Noah.
Noah, and this is Noah, and that was Noah?
No, this is Noah. Nun Aleph Hey. Not no, it's not Nun Chet. Oh.
Okay.
Go on.
They now stood before Moshe, Eleazar, the priest, the princes, and the entire community at the communion tent entrance with the following petition. Our father died in the desert. He was not among the members of Korach's party who protested against God, but he died because of his own sin without leaving any sons. Why should our father's name be disadvantaged in his family merely because he did not have a son? Give us a portion of land along with our father's brothers. Moshe brought their case before God.
Okay, are you following this? Here's the deal. The thing is that in the basic biblical inheritance laws, the inheritance is passed on to the sons, as far as the land. Okay? Well, insofar as issue of modern day wills and inheritance, it's a little different. But in the time of the Chumash, clearly, there were other issues of, you know, support for women, you know, the ketubah, other mechanisms. The bottom line is, Slavchan, who was entitled to a portion of the new land of Israel, he didn't have his sons. From the basic law, they're not getting any other, that land is going to be given to the tribe and absorbed into the portion of the tribe. And everybody can get a little more extra land. So they said, why should we be disadvantaged or be diminished or not get because of the Shema Avinu, the name of our father's name? Okay, so it's interesting. What did they, okay, they said, and apparently Moshe felt, was this a good question?
He did?
Yeah, because he didn't answer them. Because he did not have an answer. He felt that their petition, their request was good.
It's a good one.
It's a good one, and the answer was not obvious. Okay, let's go on.
So a question about this, though. Wasn't there, like, back in, like, Yitro, didn't he have this whole, like, new, like, structure? So did they, like, start out, like, petitioning to, like, kind of, like, the lower level leaders, and then it got, like, raised up to, like, Supreme Court, like, Moshe's level?
That's a good question. I don't know. But clearly, you see, they're going right to the top shelf. They come there. And by the way, you see, they're not intimidated. They're going there to the, let's say, they're going there. There's Moshe, Aaron's, you know, who took place of Aaron's son, Eleazar, all the princes, and the community. So, with you know, they're going in front of the entire leadership. So, number one, they feel they are correct. They are not intimidated, and they feel very cool, calm, and collected, and they make their case. Okay, this is all part of the composite of the title of the class, Woman Power, okay? So they're not intimidated. Jewish woman, by the way, when they're doing the right thing, they're not intimidated. They have a clear case. The fact that they're standing in front of the entire nation or the leadership of the nation, no, they're going. They're committed. They're going. Let's see what goes on. Next.
All right. Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, the daughters of Tselafchad have a just claim. Give them a hereditary portion of land along their father's brothers. Let their father's hereditary property thus pass over to them. Speak to the Israelites and tell them that if a man dies and has no son, his hereditary property shall pass over to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then his hereditary property shall be given to his brothers. If he has no brothers, you shall give his property to his father's brothers. If his father had no brothers, then you shall give his property to the closest relative in his family, who shall then be his heir. This was the decreed law for the Israelites, as Hashem had commanded Moshe.
Okay, so let's stop. This is scene number one. So they put forth their case, and they get a thumbs up. Hashem agrees with them, and that becomes a law. Now let me ask you a question. What do you think was the motivation of the daughters of Tselafchad? What are the possibilities?
Concern for their family name, personal wealth, ability to maintain a family or have an inheritance to share with the husband. I don't know.
All right, so one thing is the stated reason is because they are concerned about the father's name. All right, so we have to understand, well, what does that mean? That's A. B is, that's just A, well, why should we be cheated out? Just, you know, our dad's entitled to money, to the property. Why should we not get a piece of the action? You know, they're claiming that they deserve to have their rightful share. Why should they be cheated out of that? That's another possibility. What do you say about this? Would you say this is a feminist gesture on their part?
Yeah.
How so?
Not necessarily in a bad way, but I mean, why should they be? I mean, I guess in this case, the feminist ideal goes back to what you just said a minute ago. I mean, why should they be sidelined when, their father wasn't a sinner and their father wasn't, he didn't throw in his lot with Korach. He's not like an outlier of the nation.
Right.
He doesn't have any sons. Why should they be sidelined from their father's lineage in that respect and be denied, a spot?
So do you agree with Mendel? What do you say?
For future women whose fathers had no sons, to make sure that this law gets passed, this gets addressed.
Well, you could argue if they were pushing for a full equality, they would say, well, maybe this law of inheritance is not just, because why should it be we only get a portion if we do not have any. If our father does not have any sons.
But if this is so feminist, then why do daughters get cut out from every other lineage after them?
No, so exactly. So that would argue they were not advocating for a revolutionary change. Because if they're arguing for revolutionary change, it would say not only should it be that in our case that
but in perpetuity,
or in every case of wills and estate, the property, both real or cash, to be distributed equally among the children,
right,
whether they be male or female. They didn't advocate for that. They just felt, they said, so they're not going for an egalitarian model here. They're going for the say, look, he didn't have a son, but why should we, you know, you could say he has maybe a quasi-egalitarian element, but what argues against that position?
That it says if he has no brothers, you shall give his property to his father's brothers. Then if he has no brothers, or it shall be given to his brothers rather than to his sisters after the brothers.
Right. So first of all, it's going to keep on the male side of the male part of the family. That's the A. And the B, they don't make that reason. Look at verse 4. Why should our father's name be disadvantaged in his father, in his family, merely because he did not have a son? Give us a portion of land along our brother's father. So they frame their argument as being that about the father's name, the Shem Avinu, father's name. What is that all about?
So if their father did have a... what did you say about shame?
Well, the Hebrew word for father's name is Shem Avinu.
Oh, Shem Avinu.
Shame. I mean, what are they trying to preserve? They're not saying we want to have the cash.
It's the father's legacy.
So what does that mean?
That he merited a portion in the land of Israel.
So let's deconstruct the concept of legacy. What is a legacy?
Your children.
A memory.
Say it again.
A memory.
Memory of your what? Children.
Memory of your ancestors.
What part about it? What aspects of the memory of the ancestors?
That when someone passed on something to their children, it's as if they were alive. Their memory is alive.
Okay, so one thing is sort of to sustain in a limited way the existence of the departed relative by keeping their memory of them alive. Okay, true. What aspects of the memory or what aspects of the what memory do people want to keep alive the most?
What, buddy?
What?
Land?
Well, is the land the memory? What's the role of the land with the whole legacy?
I feel like it says this person had a good work ethic. This person was a good worker and did what they were supposed to in their life. They weren't a schlub.
Well, that's okay. So, that would be in a case like in a modern case where the person owned and worked a piece of property, and their effort, their contribution to development of a city, town, or community is memorialized, or is turned into that property becomes the monument to them or of them. Okay.
It could also be that that's the location where they establish themselves. So if a person establishes themselves on that spot of land and had a home and, you know, et cetera, that's their place.
Right.
And children can choose to carry on that legacy if they want to, based on laws of inheritance, I guess.
Yeah, but their father never stepped foot in the land of Israel ever. His entire life.
But the inheritance belongs to all of us.
Say that again, Jenna.
The inheritance of the land of Israel, the portion of the land of Israel, belonged to each of the tribes.
Yes.
So why would their father be denied that?
No, but my question is, how does that support, strengthen, underline the legacy of their father by them taking a possession of land in the land of Israel?
Wait, I thought they were not in the land of Israel.
Currently, they're not, but they're looking forward to. They're on the border, and they're looking forward to, and they're going to go in there within a couple of months.
And so they're hoping to get a parcel of land in the land of Israel, where they haven't been yet, based on their father's inheritance, while he didn't own any land in Israel.
Yeah. So the land in the previous chapters, the land they parceled up the land. They're going to divide up. Since you have the land, you have the tribe of Manasseh. They get, let's call it 1/12 of the land, right? And they break it down based upon families. So they're part of the Machir family or the Hefer family.
Right.
The Hefer family, they get a series of fields. So Slavchad would be entitled, or if he had sons, his sons would get that part of land, which was ascribed to that family. So they want to take over the family plot of land, which they're going to get as being the first immigrants to the land of Israel. So my question is, what are they trying to accomplish by doing that? Because one thing that, like, just to review, Suzanne pointed out, in modern life, when you have somebody who builds a business, so it's very important for the family to preserve the business, because that becomes a part of the legacy. All the hard work, efforts of the departed is manifest in the functioning business. You know what I'm saying? There's a whole, in America, a lot of businesses are multi-generational family businesses. It's a big thing. And the name of the originator, the founder of the business, is usually in the lobby, and there's a picture, and there's a bio. You know what I'm saying? You've all seen that, right? You know what I'm talking about? So my question is, what is she trying to accomplish in the land of Israel? What do you guys say?
I think they're trying to make sure that the family of the land, even though there's no male to inherit it, it's to make sure that the family has a claim to their own piece of land in Israel.
Well, is that because they were just simply interested in ensuring or having a... Is that just simply because they were interested in real estate?
Well, let me ask you this. If without this divine intervention, who does the land go to?
If you would have asked Moshe, who did not know, it would have been absorbed in the tribe. It would have stayed with the tribe of Manasseh and probably been divided up to the rest of the family.
So there wasn't any damage to the tribe by them not.
No, no. But they want to preserve the father's name among their father's brothers by getting a land that's ascribed to him. My question, I'm just drilling down here. What are they trying to accomplish? What is animating these women?
It really seems like preserving the memory of their father, that he be physically represented somewhere in the land of Israel after the life that he lived. That's all
right. Now, why do they care so much?
Well, maybe it's like honoring like your parents, like honoring your father and mother.
Yes. It's a basic kibbut av and aim, a basic honoring your parents is that when they pass on, you want to preserve, you know, their memories, whether it be the, you know, whether it be inter- maybe be the, you know, of course, like the, you know, whether it be the certain positive fun and games memories you had as a child, that's maybe you're not going to preserve, that's going to be, you know, left to pictures and personal reflections. But then, but as far as there's the ideals of the parents, what they stood for, their values. And apparently that seems to be what they, in other words, they didn't want that, that their dad, Slavkhod, his identity should basically evaporate from the face of the earth. That was to them an extremely painful notion, especially when the Jewish people are going to start the Jewish nation, the land of Israel, where the land, each part of the land is identified not by not only by tribe and not only by family, but also individuals within the family. That's Slavkhod's portion, his field. They did not want that to be dissipated. They had a they felt that their dad stood for stuff, which meant that they and they didn't want that to go away. It doesn't sound like, because if it was basically about we want to have a piece of land, they would have said, why should we be disadvantaged because he did not have a son? That would have been the claim of, which is still legitimate, but they frame it as, why should our father's name be disadvantaged in his family merely because he did not have a son? It seems that she's putting forward about the shame of Inu. You have a similar idea. Well, let me ask you, where do you have a similar idea which is memorialized in an actually mitzvah in the Torah? There's a mitzvah in the Torah, one of the 613 mitzvot, that deals with this very concern. I'll give you guys a hint. It's when a person dies and he also leaves no sons. What is the mitzvah from the Torah?
Is it when the closest relative got to marry the widow?
Correct.
To continue the name?
That's exactly it. The other brother has a, there's a mitzvah of Yibum, of the Levirate marriage, where he will marry his brother's widow to preserve the shame of Achinu, the shame is his brother's name. It's a similar idea.
So and, is it only if the brother doesn't have sons, or if the brother doesn't have children in general?
My impression of it means he has no, if he has children, there's no mitzvah. If he has daughters, I think there's still no mitzvah. I have to double check that. I'm not 100% sure. But
okay.
Basically, he has no children at all. So that's the mitzvah, is to preserve the brother's name by the Levirate marriage. Now, if the guy does not want to do it, he has there's a thing called, like, it's like the divorce for Yibum. It's called Chalitza. And it's viewed as being somewhat of a disgrace that he's not taking care about his brother's legacy. In other words, preserving the person's legacy, and not just their silly legacy, you know, like they like, you know, grilled cheese sandwiches on Sundays, but the more significant, what they stood for. It appears that was a motion seemed to sense, feel the integrity and the sincerity of the request, and that's it. So the point being is that, first of all, number one, what do you see about these women? Let's see if we can deconstruct the character of these women. And then I'm going to, in another part, show you what they actually did. Go on. Give me some qualities about these women that you can deduce from this story.
They're intellectually sophisticated.
Yes, they put together. Well, what's your proof?
The fact that Moshe went to God with this issue.
Right, he was stumped. This was the first Ask the Rabbi question recorded in the Torah where the rabbi did not know the answer. And let me tell you, it wasn't the last time. Okay? So the first one to stump the rabbi at the Ask the Rabbi session was the Daughters of Slavchad. There you go. Number one. What else?
They were righteous.
What was righteous about them?
That they merited to receive the land, and that they were keeping it in line with honoring with the mitzvah of honoring their father.
Right. You see that they had this concern. They could have said, "Look, he died," and you know.
I don't understand why that concern can't be interpreted as selfish. Instead, it seems like they're audacious and bold. I'm not sure that they're
definitely bold because they have no problem putting forth their claim in front of Moshe and the high priest and the prince. Right. So we see that where they're intellectually honest, intellectually sophisticated, they are bold.
I'm not sure how they would be interpreted as righteous. I guess I just don't understand that.
Well, because they don't say why. They could have said, why should we be disadvantaged because dad did not have a son? They didn't say that. They say, why should our father's name be disadvantaged in his family because he didn't have a son? You know what I'm saying?
Maybe I missed something, but I thought you mentioned that this event did not change the laws of inheritance.
It did.
Oh, okay. I thought that was the case, but for some reason, maybe I just misheard something somebody said. I wasn't under the impression this changed. I don't know if it entirely upended, but this changed the laws of inheritance.
It did. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, it's an interesting question, which I was waiting for somebody to ask me. The question is, well, was this always the plan? In other words, if the Daughters of Slavchad never came, would we have this law?
No.
So you could argue, like Mendel, no.
It's not much of an argument, but I think I think I would make the case for no.
And what would that case be? So it could be. So
I'm going to argue we would have had them anyway.
Okay, go ahead. So, go ahead. What do you got? Give me the case for each one of your positions.
I'll let him go first.
I say no.
It's a very good debating move. Let him go there, guy. Mendel, you're on.
Somebody won at moot court in high school. That's what that is. What's it called? I say no because this is clearly an instance of a question that was not thought of by a person until these people came along. But the question had to be addressed to God Almighty. So it's something about it is not intuitive or obvious in any way, so much so that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have an answer for it. So if the women of Tzalafcha didn't come up with this question, or if some subsequent individual didn't come up with this question, we would not therefore have the law, because it seems like the law was contingent on somebody asking the question in the first place. If nobody ever asked the question, we wouldn't have the law, unless it was divinely given by God. But the Torah had already been given. So,
well, that's an interesting question. Is the Torah given? Is it sealed? Is it canonized?
Well, as far as the Tanakh goes, it seems so, right?
Well, where are we? Are we in the book of Shoftim, Yoshua,
Nehemiah? No.
We're in about Midbar.
But I'm saying that
question. When does the Chumash end?
But when does the Chumash end? At the end of Devarim.
Okay, well, we got a book and a quarter to go.
We have a book and a quarter to go. Okay. All right, well, the question was...
No, I'm giving you a support, actually, that you could argue, like Mendel's arguing, that in reality is that this was, since the system is not changed, this question was raised, and this was given. All right, but you could argue that, and that's the story. So why should I assume it was going to be given later? All right, so Moshe Chaim Dodes, what's the counter-argument?
Counter-argument is that the mitzvot are perfect. It's not like God didn't think of this. It's just that it wasn't applied until this point. When they get into Israel, certainly there would be issues that this would be brought up at some point. And even if no one brings it up, it would have, these things would get, and God, let's say even God doesn't communicate it to them directly. The rabbis would still have to reason it out, and they would likely arrive at something similar to this, even though this was upending a lot of the hierarchy in a lot of ways.
Okay, so that by the way, officially is the counter-argument. Correct. Well done. The point of the matter is that if this is the just rule, then what? So then you'll say, well, the Torah was going to be given imperfectly? If this is the perfect law, that in the case of this situation, so why, you're going to have a circumstance of that the imperfect law is going to be given, and then it'll have to be post-game show sort of amended? So it's, you know, it's okay. I don't have an. I'll tell you right now. I don't have an answer. I'm sorry.
It's a good argument, though.
But no. But I'm saying these are. I'm just saying. But even getting two are putting out on the table two logical possibilities, and to do further research to think. But that's, you know, that's good stuff. Now, well,
couldn't you also say that this was all in like Hashem's plan, that like he knows everything? So when it was initially set up, like he knew that this would be an opportunity for like the daughters to. Like make a Kiddush Hashem by honoring their father like in this way.
Well, if you're gonna do like, you know, if you're gonna play that game there, Sean, or so let's say, let's hold back five of the mitzvahs and see if the Jews ask for them. You know, it's like, it seems a little strange. In other words, if you're supposed to be, if Hashem's supposed to deliver the Torah, he's supposed to give you a basic package. Now, by the way, the Torah was given not in its totality. It's as far as the basic principles, and there's the rules of the oral law, which are going to unpack, allowing further unpacking. But that's not going to happen when God's still available and Moshe's still available to sort of still be involved in the initial process, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that's illogical, but then the question is, well, why only there are a couple of myths. Also, the Jews asked for in Balotcha, couple parshas ago, the Jews who are tamei and could not celebrate the first Pesach offering says, Lama nigara, why should we be diminished to not be able to offer the korban of God of the korban Pesach? Okay? So if that, the same question applies. If they wouldn't have piped up over there, we wouldn't have what they call Pesach Sheni, the second chance of the korban Pesach? It's the same question. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm putting that down. We had good arguments from Moshe Chaim and from Mendel, and I'm gonna start here. And if I get more than 5 seconds, and I do a little research, and I get, if there's, I'm sure there's an article to discuss that, and I'll share with you guys.
Rabbi, can I ask a question before you move on?
Yes.
Is there a reason in the inheritance, the way it goes, that the only women are the that would get it are the daughters, and not the father's sister or mother if there are no brothers?
That's interesting. Well, the question, the larger question is, and I don't have a quick and easy answer, is that why in the biblical inheritance laws is it going purely, in a patriarchic manner, father to son, father to son, father to son, except for this exceptional case?
Well, it's not this exceptional case. Didn't we just discuss that this changed the law forever?
No, but if Slufwood had one son, that son would have got everything, and those five daughters would have got nothing.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That didn't change.
So your question is, why does it go father to son at
well,
all?
I'm just saying, I'm asking a more global question. A postscript to this, the already in the 1300s and even earlier, they already started to create halachic workarounds where women would also inherit the father. Okay, now how to work that around? So I'm not going to go into the which of course begs the question: if it's legitimate or right to share or distribute to all members of the family. why wasn't that not done in the biblical era? Or so that's a good question. That's a sort of a global question. You know what I mean? I'm just our focus here is more on the exceptional personalities of the daughters of Slavkhod, but I'm just saying it does point questions in more broader themes. Okay, which are good to explore. But I only got an hour, so I gotta get cracking. So I want to fast track. Anyways, I'm gonna summarize this. I can't read this because I got bound to 3 minutes. So I'm gonna at the end of the book of Bamidbar, the story does not end because the other members of the tribe said, "Hey, Moshe, we got a problem here because those five ladies, if they go marrying people from the tribe of Dan and Gad and Zebulun, what's going to happen?
That tribe is going to get more land than they should have.
They're taking the land, their Menashe land, and it's going to be now going to have a little bit of plot of Zebulun here, and down the road is going to be a little plot of Asher land because they're going to marry, they're going to have sons, and then the son's going to inherit, and that kid from some other tribe."
I thought that back then people were not permitted to marry someone outside of your tribe.
Well, you see from the fact that the leaders of the tribe were concerned that was not the case. Because if everybody married within their tribe, then there would have been no problem. But they were concerned that, you'll read the text yourself, I'll read 36:3. If they marry a member of another Israelite tribe, but then the hereditary property coming from us, from our fathers, will be diminished and will be added to the tribe into which they marry. So they're concerned that they're going to be, you know, there's intermarriage between Jew and non-Jew, and now there's intertribal marriage, which is going to cause their inheritance, their tribal land to be larger. And that ain't cool. So, Moshe, here's their question. Does he have an answer? Does Moshe have an answer?
No, I guess he goes back to God with the same issue.
There you go. It says, Moshe gave the Israelites instruction at God's command. So that means he had to inquire. He says, the tribe of Joseph descends having a just claim. They also got a good point. So what do they got to do? They got to marry in the same tribe. They got to date at the MJE in the Menashe tribe. They cannot be dating at the MJE in the tribe of Zebulun or the MJE in the tribe of Asher. They got to be local.
Isn't there just a penalty if they do that? Don't they just have to give up their hereditary claim to the land if they marry outside the tribe?
One second.
Doesn't seem clear whether it's optional to accept the land or not.
No, and the inheritance will not be transferred. It won't be transferred. Correct. You're right. They'll lose their land.
Yeah.
Correct. Mendel's correct. So what did they do? So it says 36:10. Slavkhod dodged exactly as God commanded, and all the five ladies married their cousins. So they didn't limit. Now the Sforno is quick to point out they didn't just marry in their tribe, they kept it in the family. Now, why? They saw what God's intention here is that there should be the identity of the family, the values of the family should be kept together with a certain land. So they intuited that, and they were willing to make the sacrifice of having to marry. Not just, they didn't limit their dating just to a tribal level of marriage choices down to their cousins. Now, no, I don't know if they only, you know, they didn't have necessarily two cousins, but still, that's a big hit. So that, by the way, in my mind, shows the altruistic nature of these women that basically they're committed to this, of the Shem Avinu, the father's name being so glad that even if they're going to limit, they're going to double limit their dating choices. One, they're dating only the tribe of Menashe. Two, they'll have to keep it into the immediate family among cousins, which they did not have to do that.
Well, not immediate family, which is good.
No, I mean, the halachically permitted immediate family, cousins. Marry your cousin, okay? So that shows to me, in other words, if it's basically, in other words, here, let's go back to our possibility. Number one, these women, although well-spoken, are pretty much interested in the land. And all this nice talk of their fathers is just, you know, very sharp, nice, political, legalistic presentation of the case. You could be jaded. You could be cynical and say that. But I argue that this shows that's not the case because nobody's going to give up their romantic preferred life just for a plot of land. I don't believe so. Okay? Especially they're going to marry some other dude and he's going to outland. It's not like they're going to lose. They're not going to be out on the street. They're going to have, they're going to be whatever. So the fact they were committed to this ideal about their father shows really that these are extremely special women. And I think it speaks broadly about what is a Jewish woman leader. Number one, she, by definition, she is thoughtful, intellectual, and principled. They're not women who are only spend their time making kugel, cholent, and cake. Because the bottom line is these women are clearly thoughtful, principled, and two, number two, they are bold.
If they can be thoughtful cooks also.
I'm not saying they couldn't be cooks. I'm sure their guys were also cooks. But next point is that they were also the second point being is that they were also not intimidated. They walked right up to Moshe, Elazar, all of the leaders, and they put forth their case. Third, they weren't necessarily trying to create a revolution. They weren't trying to be a Korach and say we're going to throw away everything. No, we think we're good with a given system, but we think there's a particular part which is unjust. And they put forth their plea. And third is they and the third point is they walk the walk, they walk the walk, and they talk the talk. In other words, even if it means their personal giving up, they're willing to do that. They gave up romantically. They did because their dating options was self-limited. First of all, if they could walk away from the land, they could say, forget this idea of the father's name. I'll go marry. I see there's a nice guy in the Zulun, and I'm going to date that guy because he's hot. And that's it. And I don't need to cock the land. They should have could have done that. Option was hers. And not only that, but they married in the cousin to keep the mishpacha, keep it, even the land and the family even more closely aligned, which was a level of greatness. And that's why in the eyes of the Chazal, they speak of the daughters of Slavkot as being very exalted women. But to be an exalted Jewish woman leader means that you are smart, you are motivated, you are principled, you are bold, and you are consistent, and even if it means you're going to take a personal hit. And if you look to Tanakh, those are many of the qualities of all leaders, whether it be Esther, or Sarah, or Rebecca, or Leah, or Avigail, or Yocheved, or Miriam, and the list goes on. So they're good models. And it's not limited to women because, quite frankly, all those qualities are good for all people. It's not a male or a female thing. Everybody should try to aspire to those qualities as well. So I just felt that saying...
Could you describe Naval's wife that way?
Avigail, oh yeah. Oh yeah, she was amazing. She stood up to King David, who had a band of 400 dudes who wanted to kill her husband and her.
Well,
and she artfully neutralized his anger and got him on board. I
understand that, but I find it really interesting that she put up with Naval for as long as she did before.
You know, Mendel, let me share you with something. You know, in life, you get dealt a hand of cards, and you do the best you can.
All right.
Maybe when she met, maybe the first years of living with Naval were some good years. But whatever, people change. It doesn't always work out. That's why the Torah has a mitzvah of divorce. And it's a sad thing to do. But when it happens, it's needed. And the bottom line is she ultimately ends up marrying King David. He dies. He has a heart attack, as you know. And she ends up going up. So the bottom line is, you don't get to choose your cards. You get the cards. What you get judgment is how you navigate the cards. That's it.
I mean, look, that's not true for poker. I'm just saying.
Well, no, it is actually true in poker. You don't get to choose the cards. You get your cards, and then you got to you got to hold them, you got to walk away, you got to hand. That's it. You got to deal with the cards you're given and try to navigate as best you can, and that's it.
Okay.
I mean, you know, she was. Bottom line is that she was an amazing woman. All right, there's a lot to go on here, but I want to go over time. And Yashkoff, you guys all for coming on a rare Thursday night pre-Shabbos Parsha extravaganza. And I wish you all a Shabbat Shalom, and we'll do it again next week.
Can you there's an episode of Pinchas spearing two people, which is
I did that last year. Go check it out online.
Okay.
That's juicy, but I don't repeat stuff. All right, so Sean and Mendel, stay on the line. I got a quick question.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.